interspaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast.
Welcome back to Interspaces, the science podcast of SIF, a center for interdisciplinary research based at Bielefeld University. I'm Rebecca Moltmann and I'm looking forward to this episode. We will be talking about self-managed abortion, which is the practice of obtaining abortion medications independently and using them to manage the abortion process without clinical supervision. Across the world and for almost two decades now, feminist activist networks have organized different strategies such as hotlines and accompaniment to support people to self-manage their abortions safely. For example, in Latin America and the Caribbean, Red Compañera brings together collectives and organizations from 19 countries across the region doing this type of work. In Africa, Mama Network mobilizes 67 organizations in 21 countries. They describe their work as training activists, disseminating information, facilitating access to abortion pills, and creating the conditions for women and pregnant people to safely self-manage their abortions. Here in Europe, Abortion Without Borders is a cross-European network supporting Polish people to access abortions both in Poland and abroad. At SIF, a research group is currently working on the subject under the title Translocal Networks for Feminist Self-Managed Abortion in the Americas and Europe, Transforming Law, Health and Culture Through Activism and Scholarship. We will talk about this extremely important topic with the researchers Mariana Aziz, Naila Vacaresa and Sara Lalea. Welcome.
Thank you.
Could you introduce yourselves, who you are, what your areas of expertise are, etc.?
I'm Sara Larrea, Ecuadorian sociologist and also a public health professional. And I work as an independent consultant with organizations who want to know more about the subjects they are working in. I do research around abortion, women's health, gender, social inequalities.
My name is Naila Luz Vacaresa. I'm based in Buenos Aires, Argentina. I studied sociology there in the public university, University of Buenos Aires. Then I did my PhD there on social sciences, and I teach feminist theories and gender studies courses at the University of Buenos Aires. And I have been researching on abortion movements and feminist movements in Argentina for almost two decades. But right now, my work is focused on the visual, on the cultural and affective aspects of these abortion struggles in Latin America.
I'm Mariana Assis. I'm based in Brazil at the Federal University of Goiás in Goiânia. I'm trained as both a lawyer and a political scientist. So my interests are on the intersection between politics, law, and gender. And for the past, I'd say, 7-8 years, I've been studying reproduction in general, but abortion specifically, and self-managed abortion, particularly the strategies that feminist movements have been deploying to ensure that people have access to safe abortion in spite of legal constraints, stigma, socioeconomic barriers.
When people think of abortion, they often think about a health procedure that takes place at the hospital and is performed by a physician. How does self-managed abortion disrupt this conventional view?
So I think that first, what is important for us is to say that when we are talking about self-managed abortion, we are talking about self-managed abortion with pills. Because self-managed abortion as such can be understood as any way that someone tries to independently and autonomously end an unwanted pregnancy. And many of these ways, they can be dangerous, they can be unsafe, they can be harmful for people who are engaging in these practices. But so this technology, the pills, they have really changed the landscape of self-managed abortion and make it safe, accessible, and easy. And so the self-managed abortion that our group is interested in is the self-managed abortion with pills. And abortion pills are a technology that are around at least the 1980s. People have been using them at least mid-1980s. And it's really transforming the field of abortion in many ways, through the ideas and the practices of multiple social actors. So perhaps Naila can tell us a little bit about how it changed.
Yeah, self-managed abortion is challenging this traditional view of abortion where you need a doctor and a clinical setting to carry out the procedure. And instead, it's involving just using medications like misoprostol alone or in combination with mifepristone. And this medication can be used safely outside of the clinical setting without medical supervision. And it has been making abortion more accessible and also giving people more control over their own bodies. And it's also, I think it's important to stress that this is a method for abortion care that is safe and effective. It's a totally safe and effective way to terminate a pregnancy. If you have the medication, you have correct information on how to use it, and you have adequate support surrounding you. So in fact, the World Health Organization has included this method in their guidelines for comprehensive abortion care, and it has been emphasizing the role of this medication and this method in expanding access, particularly in restrictive contexts and also in contexts that has limited resources at the health systems.
So if you decide to have an abortion in like some country who has a liberal abortion laws, do you get the information directly from your doctor, or how does it work? Because, I mean, there are different methods to have an abortion, right? So you can have like surgically kind of surgery and the pills, and you just get the information. Okay, you can take this and that. That helps you. Okay. But only in these countries, right?
No, but it also depends. It's different in each country. Even if you have liberal abortion laws, then you have different processes in the hospitals, right? Or the medical center. So in some places, the doctor will give you the information and the prescription, and then you go to the pharmacy, buy the pills, take it at home. In other places, they will give you the pills in the facility and then watch you have the first pill and then take the other pills and take them at home or wherever you prefer. And in some countries, they are now creating these telemedicine services where you can contact the doctor from home and then receive the pills and take them at home. But it depends.
Anyway, I'm asking because I recently saw a video by someone who didn't want to have an abortion, but the baby just didn't like develop further. And she had a doctor who like really said, no, you have to have like the surgical way and it's not a good idea to use this and that. And I found that interesting because it was Germany and I was really irritated. So I think it also depends like on the doctor maybe, because I mean, they obviously also have different opinions probably on that subject, right?
Yeah, and I think the idea of self-managed abortion, particularly from this activist perspective, is that it really challenges medical authority over the decision. So in a way like this, it's not only the doctor who has to be heard in order to choose what is the best method, what works for one person or another. Of course, there are health protocols, and those health protocols will tell you when it's better to have an abortion with pill or a surgical abortion or a vacuum aspiration and so on. So there are different methods. And in some cases, one method will be preferable than the others. But certainly the person who is undergoing the process, she needs to be heard and decide also what works best for her.
Yeah, so with this method, you have a great potential to increase autonomy for people needing to make decisions about their bodies, their reproductive lives. And so even in places where there's a lot of stigma, where laws are restrictive or where care is inaccessible, like if you have access to the pills and you have good information and you have support around you, you just do it peacefully in your home.
I'm considering, like, because I think most people don't really have an understanding of which countries and how many countries in the world have liberal abortion laws or which don't. Can you say something about that?
I think it's interesting, actually, like, to go back in time and understand how we come to so-called today liberal abortion laws. Because in the early 19th century, abortion was not even an issue for the law. So many countries, they start passing criminal laws to prohibit people to have abortion, which is something was before just a life event in people's reproductive lives that they would take care of with the help of midwives or traditional healers, really like in this space that was understood like broadly as women's health. So countries start enacting law under push or the impulse led mainly by medical professional associations. So this is the history that we have in the US, in Brazil, in the UK, in Australia, I think all over the world, it was really the medical profession in order to assert itself as a different kind of profession, more scientific, more well-trained than, for example, midwives or traditional healers, that started asking for criminalization of abortion. So they could assert their jurisdiction over in which cases abortion would be allowed, which were very rare exceptions. So this first wave, and I would say that like the 19th century was really saw as this century of the criminalization of abortion. That's when abortion becomes an issue for the law and for criminal law specifically. And then in the 20th century, as feminists, women's movements start organizing and mobilizing, they start challenging this idea that abortion should be understood as a crime. It was just a life event. Why should we criminalize the ways in which people deal with their reproductive lives? And that's where they start pushing for so-called liberal abortion laws. So this happened, I would say, mid-1960s, 1970s. And so you have judicial decisions, as happened here in Germany. You first had a court decision in the U.S., in Canada. In other cases, you have liberal abortion laws passed. And the landscape today is that I think Europe, most of European countries, they have so-called liberal abortion laws. North America used to be a place where there were liberal abortion laws, but with the reverse of Roe v. Wade, which was the Supreme Court decision that allowed people to have abortion, this has changed dramatically. Latin America used to be a region well known for prohibit abortion laws, but this has also been changed in the past few years with Colombia, Argentina, Mexico, Uruguay, liberalizing abortion in different forms. And then Africa is still a region with very restrictive abortion laws. But I think that something that's really important for us to understand is that when we are talking about liberal abortion laws, most of them, it does not mean that abortion is not a crime anymore. So liberal abortion laws allow people to have abortions under a specific circumstance assigned by the law. So you still have gestational limits, you still have limits regarding who can perform an abortion, in what space, with what methods. So legalization has not meant that people have total freedom to decide on their own terms. So very few countries have completely decriminalized abortion. And one example is Canada, where there is no criminal abortion laws anymore. But other countries, such as here in Germany, you still have abortion as a crime in the penal code.
I don't know. I think it's just such an emotional topic even to research about. I would be angry all the time. I'm really grateful that you're doing this work. So I mentioned in the introduction that feminist activists have organized around self-managed abortion strategies for almost two decades now. Could you tell us a little bit more about self-managed abortion, its history, and how it became an activist strategy? I mean, you already covered some ground there, but maybe mainly about the activist strategy.
Yeah, so the thing is that there are two pills. You said that already, right? There is mifepriston that was created for abortions, and there is misoprostol that was created for other things and that you can use alone to have an abortion. You don't need the mifepriston. So there was like 20 years of research, I think, before the pill was like put into the market. Misoprostol was put into the market in the 80s, I think. And it was in the market because it was used to treat gastric ulcers. So people could access it. It was not very restricted. It was easy to get in pharmacies. And then in Brazil, women started using it, discovered that it worked to end a pregnancy, and started using it and telling others that they could use it to have abortions. And then there was a lot of like interest from researchers in Brazil who started trying to understand how it worked. 20 years after of this evidence, the World Health Organization included the first protocol of how to safely use the pills based on all this evidence. And then feminist activists started to understand that if the World Health Organization was saying that this is safe to use and it's taking 12 pills in 3 doses, you know, like not very complicated, then this information could be used as an activist strategy to increase access in places where the laws are restrictive or there are no people providing it or there's any difficulties with access. And then they, feminists created these different strategies. So in some places it would be providing information through telephone lines and then letting people go to the pharmacy and buy the pills because they were very available in Latin America at the time. In other places, it was creating these networks of feminists that will accompany you through the abortion, so be with you, give you the information, but also like the practical support through the whole process. And there are many, many other strategies around this. Letting people know they can use pills to have an abortion safely, and then supporting and creating the conditions, as the Mama Network says, so people can actually use this method and kind of exercise their power over their own bodies.
Yeah, so I think what is really important there is that activists, they took advantage of both this knowledge that had been generated about how to use the pills safely, the protocols that were being produced by researchers, the World Health Organization. And so they turned this knowledge, which used to be monopoly of both researchers and medical power, into popular knowledge, right? So they would popularize this through telephone hotlines, but also through really funny and nice publications, such as the one in Argentina, no? From Lesbianas, which is like this very colorful book that you can read about like what to expect, how to use the pills, how to take care of yourself. And then on the other hand, they also started circulating this knowledge. And I think that is really interesting, the ways in which you have these connections between activists working in very specific contexts, but how they started spreading this knowledge for other networks, for other activists, and people start adapting to their own conditions. So where it's possible to access mifepristone and misoprostol, they will use the protocol with the two pills. Where it's not possible to access the two of them, you can just use the protocol with misoprostol alone. So there is a lot of flexibility as well in this activist strategy. So it's a very different way of dealing with abortion. I think it's very humane, in the sense that it acknowledged that the person, and one of the activists who was here with us, Ruth Grub Zurbriggen, she has this really nice phrase that she says, the abortion does not belong to me, does not belong to the judge, does not belong to the police or to the doctor. The abortion belongs to the person who is undergoing the process. So it really centers the person in the process, and it adapts the entire environment and the conditions to those conditions that are the best for the person to have the experience that she wants.
Because you already talked about the stigma of abortion that still is around. I have the feeling that if you have like a network or if you see people are like advocating for that, it's kind of destigmatizing process as well, right? So your research group is designed around the idea that feminist activism is producing changes in the ways abortion is thought about and done in various fields, such as law, health, and culture. Could you tell us more about these changes?
Yes, I think building on what you were saying about stigma, these organizations, this movement was really interested, like from the start, not only in like addressing the law, trying to change the law or circumventing the law, not only like focusing on how doctors treat this and how the health system work, but also they were like really addressing that cultural norms are not only made in the criminal courts, on in the hospital, but social norms are also constructed based on stigma, on prejudice, on moral preconceptions, religious. Also, religion takes an important part. So these movements have addressed culture as a key field of contestation for them. And they want to change the narrative. Like Mariana was mentioning, there are these handbooks that the organizations are producing in different countries. And if you take a look to those handbooks, you will see like a complete different narrative about abortion that is contesting this idea of common sense that abortion is always something horrible, something very sad, something really painful. So they are creating new narratives about abortion, new images, using art, using graphic design, different forms of storytelling, music. We were mentioning songs of protest. Like in our workshop, we have a beautiful moment with one of the activists that came from Africa, showed us a song about medication abortion. And we came together singing this song as a form of protest and also as a way to encounter each other, to attune each other. So this is a very important field of contestation, and also this movement addressing that imagination, common sense, and it's part, integral part of the dispute. For example, presenting abortion as something that is easy, that you can resolve in a practical way, like you just can solve the problem you're facing and move on. It's been really important. And also changing emotions around abortion, trying to build other narratives that are not about sadness or about guilt, but about self-affirmation, autonomy, also being in the company of others, affirming your autonomy, but being surrounded by activists that support you, like collective care, like it's a really important aspect of this cultural work.
I think it's very important to understand how, for each individual, it's just a different topic. Because, you can have your own opinions about the topic and you don't have to do it. But, for every person, the story is so different. And I don't really understand. You encounter it a lot in your research, I guess. Because why do people have to put this, overarching thing onto that subject and not regarding, what's the situation? And I don't mean, if you're raped, you can have an abortion. Then it's okay. But, the individual situation of the person. Why is that so complicated for so many people? I don't get it.
Yeah, I think there's history about this. No? There has been institutions building these kind of visions. Also morals has a history. And misogynistic, I think, preconceptions about how should women behave, how should women live or also live their sexuality specifically. So I think that's what we are dealing with. And that's why is this such a difficult task? And why multiple actors are coming together and addressing this subject, this topic in different ways, not just the law, health, also from multiple cultural interventions, doing in social media, in the press, doing many different things.
And as I said, I think it's such an important and also emotional subject. How did you get invested in this research topic? What was your individual way to the research?
So my history with this topic, I came to the world of self-managed abortion first as a feminist lawyer. So I had this friend who contacted me and told me there was this organization that needed a feminist lawyer to help them with something. I had no idea of what it was, but then I took the plane and went to meet this person somewhere in Brazil. And then they told me there was this organization that needed support, legal support, to think about security protocols for people who were self-managing their abortion or for those who were helping them self-manage abortion. And so I started working with activists, developing these protocols, doing risk analysis of what is involved. And then later, when I finished my PhD, and then I had the opportunity to do some postdoctoral research, I thought to myself, why not study this, right? It's so interesting. I'm so already aligned with the movement. And for me, it has always been important to connect theory with practices, to understand what are the social conditions of the knowledge that I am producing, but also what is the social impact of that knowledge. So it just felt a natural decision to come and studying something that I was already so invested in, and that I think it's under-researched topic. And at the same time, it's so, so important because it allows us to understand different forms of power that continue to assign people to different roles in our society. And I think that just connecting what Naila was saying, right? So I think at the center of this is really the idea of feminized bodies and the mandate of motherhood, right? And these is so, this limits so much the possibilities and the visions of what is a good life for people who can get pregnant. And then I think activism around abortion, it challenges it like in such a radical way that other forms of feminist activism might not, right? Like challenging this, it's almost like a path. Something that you are condemned, you know, in life is like to be a mother. If you can get pregnant, that's your natural path. And that's so deterministic. But we don't think like how important it is to challenge this idea that has become so naturalized.
I got invested in the subject of abortion from very young. I was a feminist activist, but a very young one. Abortion is very restricted still. So I was at this age where people were getting pregnant without wanting to and then trying to find solutions. I think at the same time, I started kind of accompanying people to find information or services and doing research. I was studying sociology at the time, so it was really interesting to me to try to understand what was happening, why was it so difficult, why there was such a taboo and stigma around it. So I started doing research then also continued being an activist, first in national organizations in Ecuador and then in other more regional or global ones. And I also continued doing research. Then I moved to public health, also trying to understand other things of how abortion works. And I've been doing a lot of my research on this, specifically self-managed abortion in the last years, and trying to understand how it could change the way we see health and health services and access to reproductive health, right? So I think you have talked a lot about how self-managed abortion changed the way society looks at abortion, but it can also change the way the medical system looks at women, I feel, and feminized bodies. So trying to understand that and to create knowledge around that, what can the medical system learn from this long activist experience creating these different ways of caring for women, caring for people who have abortions? Yeah, that has been my path.
Yeah, and for me, I think like to tell the story of how I became invested in this topic, I cannot tell this story without saying that this is like the defining struggle of my generation of feminists in Argentina. I, like Sarah, I became involved in the feminist movement being very young in the 90s. I was in high school and there were like conversations about sexual freedom, reproductive autonomy, about access to contraception at the time. And also there was a huge conversation about clandestine abortion and illegal abortion, because at the time there was no self-managed abortion. It wasn't disseminated like it is today. So in the early 2000s, when I moved to Buenos Aires to study sociology, I was really lucky because there were a few feminist professors doing gender theories courses and gender studies courses, and they were also involved in the feminist movement and in the struggles for abortion. At the time, there was a huge political crisis and economical crisis and social crisis in Argentina. And that was really a moment of opportunity. The movement started growing. The feminist movement built alliances with the human rights movement, with grassroots movement, with the LGBTQ movement. And the first national campaign for the right to legal, safe, and free abortion was formed at the time. And so as a young student and then young scholar, I had like this great opportunity of working with these feminist professors that were looking to make research that was meaningful for the movement and meaningful to change public conversation. So when the hotlines about self-managed medical abortion came to be in Argentina around 2009, I think, I was like really being part of a trend, I don't know how to put it, of doing research that was meaningful for the collectives and also bringing the collectives to the university to talk about what they were doing. And also like in changing public conversation, like not just producing knowledge for the academia or to talk among us, but to try to produce meaningful knowledge to change things.
I think it's so interesting because everyone has like different paths and ways into the research they are doing, but it's obviously always has like a little common ground for the goal, the overall goal you have with your research.
And I think everyone has personal histories with their research topics, right? But I think just other fields or a very traditional view of researchers, they just do not acknowledge that, right? So someone does not get interested like to study whales and how whales reproduce out of nothing. Something has ignited their interest, but people do not often acknowledge what are the personal histories and how the personal histories are connected with your investment in particular topics.
I once recorded a podcast for like another podcast I'm doing, and the guest said like research is me search. That just sticked. I think it's often like I'm coming from literary studies, and there you always have to like to distance yourself from your work. I think it's people have complex in the literary studies because people from other disciplines, like I don't know, would it be medicine or physics, think, oh, why do you study literature? What's the worth of that? I think that's often the case, but I think it's very true. So research is definitely me search. How many fellows are in your group? And I don't want to say something wrong.
Nine and plus then plus Suzanne, who couldn't come in person. So 10 people.
And how many disciplines and fields are represented in the group?
I'd say like around 4 or 5.
Yeah, because there's like overlaps. Yeah, and also, I don't know, like trained in sociology, but I do cultural studies, and that's the case. Many of us, we were already doing interdisciplinary work.
Yeah, I think that's mostly the case with people who are interested in like connecting to other disciplines, that they already are doing some more like transdisciplinary research, so to speak. Activists are not only an important asset to a movement fighting for women's or humans' self-ownership of their bodies, but they are also represented in your group, and it's not a given that activists are included in research projects, at least from my experience. How did that, I mean, in this case, it's quite obvious why you should include activists, but I think there's the researchers who wouldn't, or like who would say to themselves and maybe like consult someone, but not like really integrate them into the research group. So how's your experience with that?
So I think it's important here to acknowledge that in Latin America and the Caribbean, we have a very long tradition of what's called investigación militante or militant research, which is this idea that like research should fulfill a political, social purpose. And the people affected by the problem or involved in the solutions for the problem, they are the ones who are actually most knowledgeable about the problems that we are trying to tackle. So there is like this idea that dividing or separating theory and practices is really problematic because they are intertwined and there is no possibility of separating them. So of course, like Marx said that very long ago, right? When he said, well, philosophers were just looking and studying the world. The issue is really to change it. So I think this impulse has always been there in Latin America. Scholars, academics who are fully committed to social transformation, to changing the patterns of inequality in our societies. And I think that most of us or all of us are in some ways feel very connected in different ways to this tradition that do not separate knowledge and practice and that really values the knowledge that comes from other spaces. So for us, there should not be a hierarchy between knowledge that is produced in academia and the universities and knowledge which are producing by communities, with the communities, and really value with these other forms of knowledge that academic knowledge has tried to separate from and also to reproduce this idea that academic knowledge is superior or better than other forms of knowledge.
Also, if we look at the self-managed medical abortion organizations and the movement, they are researchers in their own way and great researchers in their own right. They do research, they theorize about what they are doing, and they produce really extremely rigorous research and also systematic research. And Socorristas in Argentina, the Socorristas Network, that is a countrywide network of organizations giving support for abortion with pills, they are like a case in point for this, because they, for 10 years now, they have been producing systematizations about what they do. And this is brilliant information, like for researchers and also for them to do advocacy and to influence public conversations. So thanks to them, we know that in 2014, they were accompanying around 1,000 people to have abortions with pills. And in the past few years, it's 10,000 each year. And they produce systematizations about what are the religious beliefs of the people they accompany, how old are they, where they live, how is their educational level, how is their work, what are they working in, how is their income. So just to stress what Mariana was saying, it's super important to look outside of academia also, like to engage with the research that these actors are doing that is super relevant.
So they produce like something like a database you can access and just check these data?
I don't think the database is available for everyone, but they have the database and they produce systematizations and also reports like yearly. And they have brought this also this information, this knowledge to the Congress when abortion legalization was being debated. Also, they bring this to social media, to the press. So it's a really important way to influence public conversation, to have the power to produce knowledge about what you're doing and be evidence-based on what you're doing.
What I find interesting about what you just said regarding the hierarchies between like, scholarly research is like more important than maybe for other communities of practice, so to speak. So it's kind of in a meta way, you are already questioning power dynamics. So that's so interesting because it's already, we talked about the medical system who like thinks they are being superior. And of course, patriarchy, who always think they are superior. So I think that's interesting because it's like in all the aspects of your research. So,
and it's not to say that these are the same forms of knowledge production. They are certainly different, right? So academia, universities, they have their own rules. You have like peer review in the journals and you have your own way. So this is not to say that, and I think time is something that I always think that is so different because activist time is much faster than academic time, right? So we have time to sit down and think and like you can take years doing something. For activists, time is really pressing and they might not always have the same amount of time. And I think that's where those collaborations, they become so powerful and important because people bring their expertise, right? And those expertise, they are different. And the times and the resources that we have, they are also different. So it's not to say that these are all the same kind of knowledge, but it's to say that there should not be a hierarchy between this knowledge and that this knowledge, they could really work in order to contribute to one another.
Yeah, that mutual enrichment only can happen if you address the differences and you like really are wishing to collaborate. And I think in our group, that was possible also because we as researchers, we come from these histories of collaborating, of being interested in doing advocacy and political intervention, in like going far beyond academia with what we are doing. So I think that was really important. And also the generosity of the activist participants that came from different parts of the world to join us and the generosity we experimented in the space of the workshop was truly, for me, a super important experience.
So I mentioned earlier that everyone's way is different concerning how did I get to my subject? What do I want to research specifically? What are the questions that really haunt me? But the common ground I talked about and the common goal, what's the common goal in the research project? What would you like to achieve? And I mean, you're here for like a month. It's not a long time, obviously, but you have been collaborating and you will definitely be collaborating further on after leaving ZIF. So what's the goal? What are the goals?
So I think that one of the main goals we had was really to create a space where we could produce knowledge collectively. Because academic work, and I think especially in the social sciences, where we don't have labs or we are not conducting experiments and things like this, this work, it often becomes very solitary, very specialized, and very self-contained. So to have this group of people who are coming from different backgrounds, from different disciplines, to spend a whole month together, bringing each their knowledge that they have accumulated about the topic, but this is really like to produce a more holistic view on the phenomena that we are all interested in studying. Because also, like, if you look at what public health researchers are doing about self-managed abortion, it's very different from someone who is looking at self-managed abortion from the cultural studies perspective. And these people, they are not often reading each other, because I think academia has become more and more and more specialized, right? So you should be like an expert in a very specific issue and topic. And so we wanted like to bring together all these different dimensions, political, historical, sociological, from the public health, cultural studies, law, all these different perspectives to examine this phenomena that is important for all of us.
Yes, and we are working also, have been working and will continue to work in palpable outcomes from this project. With Mariana, we envisioned an edited book coming out from this experience. Each of the participants will write a chapter, and we are working now on a book proposal. So we are like really looking forward to that. And also we thought about putting together a syllabus for a course on self-managed medical abortion, because we think teaching is an important part of what we do, like not just produce results from our research, but also like teaching and giving students the opportunity to become involved in these topics. And also, like, a group of the participants are working on a written document that would have the key takeaways from the workshop of the knowledge we produced together during those 3 days to share widely among the activist networks. So this is in terms of concrete output we are thinking about.
But we also want to continue working together in other new projects. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this space gave us the opportunity, I feel, to build relationships and build ideas together, like future projects. That's also a very, very important result of these days, I think.
We are really looking forward to continue like the conversations we started here. We started earlier, really, because we have been having Zoom meetings before we came here. And now we have more things to do together. But I think this being in person for 1 month gave us a complete different and important opportunity to build knowledge. So I think we will continue meeting online, but I hope we can meet in person again, because this was so very relevant for us.
Always come back to Bielefeld. We are lucky to have you. Do you have any tips for people who would like to find out more about the topic? So, because your syllabus and your book obviously are not out yet. So are there books, podcasts, resources, you talked about handbooks, that you can recommend for our listeners who want to inform themselves more about the topic?
So all the networks that we spoke about, they all have their websites with their publications there, as Nyla was saying. And Sara has been working with some of these networks too, in public health publications. So this is all available in their website. So I would just mention Rede Companheira is one of them. So you just Google Rede Companheira and you get their website, and they have information, but their publications, Mama Network, Abortion Without Borders, Women Help Women, which is an organization that provides telehealth service for people wanting to have an abortion. There were several books published recently, something that we haven't spoken about, but the pandemic was really a turning point in terms of self-managed abortion. So something that before was considered, oh, this is like this clandestine method, this is like this lesser method, you know, like not so good as the surgical abortion, with the pandemic, what happened was that several countries started passing legislations and offering people abortion via telemedicine, which is not the same thing as self-managed abortion we are talking here, and I think it's really important. But this knowledge that had been produced by the activists, it was really important for this turn to happen, because they have been doing self-managed abortion for so long, and they have shown it's safe. So the pandemic, I think, really expanded and people start getting more interested. So a few books to mention, it's Abortion Beyond the Law, Building a Global Feminist Movement for Self-Managed Abortion by Naomi Brine, that tells a little bit of the history that we spoke about here. Another one is Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders by Sydney Calking. And one that just came out last week, I was taking a peek at it, Abortion Pills, U.S. History and Politics, because now abortion with pill has also become a really hot topic in the U.S. by Carrie Baker.
Another book by Deidre Duffy, another colleague, it's called Abortion Trail Activism, The Global Infrastructures for Abortion Access.
I was thinking there's a lot of podcasts in Spanish from the collectives. I don't know the names of all of them, but if you look Aborto Feminismo, there's a lot of podcasts. There's one in Peru called Las Públicas. I know it was being produced, I don't know if it's up yet, but there's another one called Preguntas Frecuentes, which is frequent questions.
There is one that I really enjoyed listening to, it, a podcast called Cover Up, The Pill Plot, which tells the history of abortion pills in the U.S., but it's quite interesting because it connects with today's anti-abortion activism as well and how they are now targeting the pills there. And of course, there is a whole cultural production that Naula was telling about. So there are so many songs. And
there's an album that was produced by one of these organizations, these colectivas, Las Parceras, in Colombia. They did this album called Aborto Libre, Free Abortion. It's available on Spotify, so if anyone wants to check, they can dance a little bit and sing the song. It's really interesting. They are making alliances also with urban music singers and artists in the scene of hip-hop, Latin American music. So it's really interesting, like, to see what's happening there also in terms of collaborations.
I think that's quite a lot. So people have a lot to catch up on, especially if they can understand Spanish. We talked a lot about the success of the collaboration in your group, but I mean, there are always challenges in interdisciplinary work. So was there something that was difficult to, like, even like combine research activist cultures or anything like that?
No, everything. They're just looking at each other like, no.
Like, it was, I think, mostly easy because we all came, like, from interdisciplinary work. So we were used to these kinds of dialogues. But from my point of view, I'm not a specialist in law or in health. So I learned a lot. Many things I didn't understand quite right and was really transforming to me. Even if I've been working with lawyers or public health experts, to be in person, in conversation, was really transforming.
Yeah, and I guess perhaps I think for me, one of the challenges might be the methods, right? Like the methodological part. So it's not so easy to read a hardcore public health study for me as it is like to read a more like cultural approach, you know, to the issue. So it takes a little bit more, but I think it's also really nice to know that we don't have to be trapped in our disciplines, that we can, you know, that we can understand what people are talking about and that we do have a common language to understand each other. And that the knowledge that we are producing, it is so much better when it is multidimensional and when it's inter or even transdisciplinary. Because I think that this segmentation, like compartmentalization of knowledge, is really problematic. And I think abortion is such an interesting issue to understand this, because the disciplines they end up reproducing, what we see as like one of the biggest problems with abortion is like this, how abortion is treated as like an exceptional issue. And then when you deal with it from a very disciplinary perspective, you end up reinforcing this idea that it's this exceptional thing, like both in health, but also in law and also in culture. And when we treat it from an interdisciplinary perspective, you can see it as a life event that can gain different understandings, that can produce different feelings on people, and that it should be treated as such. Like, it's so much more complex, but at the same time, so much more simple than the disciplines make it.
Thank you so much for having been here at the podcast and talking with me about that subject. I wish you a very good journey home, because it's almost the end of the research group time, the visiting group time. Thank you so much for having been here and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, it's been a wonderful month.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's going to be a long goodbye. We don't want to leave. Thank you.
That's always nice to hear. And as usual for the listeners, you can find anything we talked about in the show notes. So the links to the different resources and networks, everything will be down there, and also the details to our guests. And yeah, thank you very much. And listen to all the other episodes, and thank you.